This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the August 1986 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is By the River, Fontainebleau, by Stephen Gallagher. We sheltered under the great oak for more than an hour, watching as the rain came down in sheets. The sky was as dark as old lead, and when the thunder came, it seemed to shake the very soil of the forest. Even Antoine couldn't pretend that this was nothing more than a brief spring shower, and so we sat together in a bleak silence, with our packs at our feet and our oilskin coats over our heads. It was then, I suppose, that I really came to my decision. When the rain finally stopped, we shouldered our baggage and walked on. The lane had now mostly turned to mud, and a weak sun showed through the trees and raised a mist from the sodden ground. I wasn't in much of a mood to a fast-running river where the lane disappeared and reemerged over on the other side, and so wet and miserable was I by this time that I waded in to make the crossing without hesitation or complaint. Every step was taking me nearer to home, and this was all that I cared for. But it soon became obvious that the track would take us no farther than the farm that stood on the opposite bank, as it led straight into a yard that had no exit. It was a mean-looking place, charmless and squalid, even in the late afternoon sunlight, and my immediate impulse was to turn around and walk away. But Antoine, ever an optimist, said, "You think they'll take pity and feed us? Oh, they're more likely to hit us over the head and rob us," I told him. "You stay here and look after the gear. I'll ask the way." I left him and went on into the yard, looking for some sign of life. A few hens were picking over the barren ground, close to where four scrawny goats stood in a makeshift pen, and a dog was barking somewhere over beyond the barn. The corner of the yard to my left was shaded by a large chestnut tree, and it was on the dry, beaten earth in the shelter of this that I saw a terrible sight. It was an underweight pig, trussed and made ready for slaughter. This was obviously the farm's regular spot for killing, because hooks had been fixed to the tree's lower branches for carcasses to be hung as they bled. What made the sight so terrible was the way in which the pig had been prepared. Each of its feet had been cut at the knuckle, sliced right back so that the bone showed bloodless and white. These bound together limbs were almost severed, but still the pig squirmed as it tried to stand. I turned my head aside and went on by. It was out in the open, on the far side of the barn, that I finally found the people that I was looking for, and an unwashed, surly crowd they turned out to be. A father and four brothers with narrow faces and a dark, piercing stare. They were hauling logs for cutting, but all work stopped when they saw me. As I addressed myself to the older man, the others simply stood and watched, their mouths open and their hands hanging by their sides, whilst a dim spark of intelligence burned in each pair of eyes. It went badly until I realized that money was the key that would unlock their patient and persistent misunderstanding. And then, at the end of the process, I learned nothing more than that the only way to regain the Paris Road would be to return along the track by which we'd arrived. I thanked the farmer, feeling defeated and foolish because, really, I ought to have been cursing him, and trudged back to Antoine. Antoine was where I'd left him, the packs with our easels and our brushes and our sketchbooks were at his feet, and he was leaning on the wall with a distant, thoughtful expression on his face. He was looking towards the chestnut tree. This was something that I'd avoided doing on my way back, but now I had to turn and see what it was that was affecting him so. And it was then I realized that the trussed pig had been taken away at some time during my short absence, and that a different scene was now before him. "I'm staying, Marcel," he said. I didn't understand. Staying where? Right here. They must have a room or a loft or a barn, and they're not going to turn down good money. And it's late, and I'm tired. Any other reason? I said. And I gave a pointed glance across to where, under the chestnut tree, a young girl was now standing and unselfconsciously brushing her hair. She was looking into a broken old mirror that she'd hung from one of the butchery hooks, and she didn't seem to be aware of us at all. She was barefoot and in a cotton shift so damp and clinging that it was plain she wore nothing underneath. To my eyes, she was nothing more than an ordinary farm girl, too heavy for grace and probably too dull for conversation, but who could say what she was to Antoine? I'd already learned during the weeks of our walking tour that his eyes and mine often seemed to see by a different light. Now, in answer to my question, he was smiling and saying nothing more. "Then," I said, "you stay alone, Antoine." This surprised him. "Are we going to argue over this?" "No," I said, leaning on the wall beside him. "Not an argument. I simply don't want to get in your way. It's over for me, Antoine, and there's no point in me pretending otherwise. I've had enough of walking and sketching and being face to face with nature. I've yawned through sunrises, and I've shivered through the rain, and if I died without ever seeing another tree or village or field of wheat, I'd be dying happy. What I'm trying to say is that I'm not an artist, Antoine. If these past few weeks have been the test, then I'm admitting that I have failed. I'm footsore, and I'm aching, and I've got nothing left to prove. I'm going back to Paris tonight." This had been my decision back in the forest and under the oak. The excursion that had seemed so appealing to two young would-be painters had turned into a drudgery of patchy weather and drafty inns and a yearning for home. I'd carried on sketching only as a kind of dogged duty, something that I wouldn't have bothered with if Antoine hadn't been there. I hadn't looked back through the pages and didn't care to. My artistic talent, I'd realized, wasn't strong enough to survive outside of the most pampered of drawing room conditions, which, I suppose, meant that it wasn't a real talent at all. A useful way of persuading young women to undress for me, perhaps, but not art. "Oh, Marcel," Antoine said with sympathy, "has it really been hell for you?" "I'm going to be a dull citizen, Antoine," I told him. "I was born to be a dull citizen. It took a trip like this to make me realize how much I'd been looking forward to it." He glanced across the yard again to where the plain farm girl stood beneath the chestnut tree. For a moment, it seemed that her eyes strayed from the mirror and met his, but her face betrayed nothing at all. "I can't come with you," he said. "I understand that." I told him where to find the farmer, and while he was gone, I transferred all of the pastels and the paints and the charcoal sticks from my luggage into his own. It was a strange feeling, the feeling of letting go of a dream. It was relief and regret inextricably mixed. I also gave him my two untouched canvases in their carrying frame and my fixing atomizer. When Antoine returned, he told me of the terms that the farmer had fixed for him to stay on. Put simply, they were giving him 2 weeks in their barn with whatever meals the family could spare in return for every franc that he carried. I was horrified, but Antoine was unruffled. He made me promise that I would go to his father and collect his monthly allowance, and that before the 2 weeks expired, I would return with the money. Although I wouldn't have cared if I never saw the forest of Fontainebleau again, I was uneasy at the notion of leaving Antoine completely at the mercy of his new obsession. This way, at least, I'd be able to check on him. He walked with me back to the river. There was little more than an hour of daylight left, and I had some way to go. Before I set out across the ford, I said, "What shall I tell your father?" "Whatever you like," he said. "Whatever you think he needs to hear. But do it for me, Marcel." I'd have said more, but he was already casting a longing look back towards the yard. A half hour's familiarity made it seem no less squalid to me than it had been at first sight. But, as I said, Antoine often seemed to see things with a different eye, an artist's eye, perhaps. My test had come and gone, and the next 2 weeks would be his. I stayed that night in Barbizon and made it back to Paris by the next evening. I entered the family home by the back door, partly because I was ashamed of what I saw as my failure, but mostly because I was aware that I looked like a tramp. The next few days saw the beginning of the process of my absorption into the family's business dealings. A strange world of ledger entries and manifests that somehow bore a relation to real ships that sailed somewhere out on real oceans. I was given a position as an apprentice clerk in order that I should be able to learn from the most fundamental of basic principles. Even though I'd known what to expect, the long hours and the rigid timekeeping came as something of a shock to me. I'd sent out a note to Antoine's parents, assuring them of his safety as soon as I'd arrived home, but it wasn't until the Friday that I was able to go and see them in the evening with his request. The news was not good. My own father, to his credit, had been willing to let my preoccupations run themselves out. It was as if he'd foreseen the final result and quietly made his preparations for when the time came around. Antoine's father had no such patience. All that he gave me was a message. There would be no allowance until Antoine abandoned his games and returned home. Saturday was a half day, and as soon as my work was finished, I set out for the railway station. It was late in the afternoon before I finally came into sight of the farm again. The place was much as I remembered it, although I dare say that I had changed in its eyes. I now wore my one decent suit and overcoat and came prepared for the shallow river crossing. It was a warm day. Spring was slipping toward summer, and the breeze no longer cut. The broken looking glass was still hanging under the chestnut tree, and it swung lightly back and forth as I stood in the doorway to the barn and called Antoine's name. He'd been sleeping here? Half of the place was taken up with hay, all the way to the upper loft, and there was nothing in the way of furniture. The slatted walls were badly fitted, and some of the gaps in the planking were a hand's width, but This was his lodging, all right, because over on the clear part of the floor, I saw his easel and a stool and some of his materials laid out. Antoine's possessions, but no Antoine. I set out to search. I finally found him in a clearing no more than 200 meters from the barn. The girl, as I'd half expected, was with him. She was sitting on the ground with her hands clasped around her knees as Antoine sketched her, but on seeing me, with a cry of, "Marcel!" he threw away his pad and jumped up to greet me. I'll confess that I was shocked, although I hid it well. In the space of less than a week, he deteriorated like a man in the grip of a serious illness. He seemed thinner, and there were dark rings round his eyes that made them seem sunken and staring. But his manner was lively enough, and he seemed pleased to see me. Although how much of this was genuine eagerness and how much of it was due to the money that he assumed I'd brought with me, I couldn't say. They had a basket with them, and together we dined on cheese and rough wine and bread that had the texture of damp thatch. Antoine introduced the girl as Lisa, short for Annalisa. I knew within a moment of hearing her speak that she was no native French girl, although her accent was one that I couldn't place. She seemed shy and ate nothing and took only a little of the wine. Antoine gave me his sketchbook to look through, just as we'd done at the end of each of our days together. As I'd expected, he'd been spending all of his time on the girl, switching between head studies and full-length portrayals, some of them hardly more than a few swift lines depicting the essence of some moment of motion. Although I didn't show it, I was disappointed. I was hoping that there would be some sign here, some showing through of the vision that had motivated him, but each drawing seemed little more than a technical exercise. Perhaps there was nothing to envy here after all, I thought. Nothing other than a casual infatuation made practical by the artist-model relationship. A situation that I, at least, could understand, although I was strangely disappointed that I found nothing more. Lisa asked if Antoine was finished with his sketching for the day, and then excused herself. I noted a certain pain in Antoine's eyes as he watched her go. "Who is she?" I said, as soon as she was decently out of earshot. "I don't know. She's an orphan, I think. The family just ignores her." "Does she work on the farm?" "I don't think so," he said, his face reflecting some of his uncertainty as if it was a question that he'd thought over a number of times in the past few days. "I can't be sure. She disappears for hours at a time, but it's not important anyway. Did you speak to my father?" I had no choice then but to give him the hard news. I saw his face fall and the air of vague contentment that had offset the wasting of his features was replaced by a kind of desperation. "Then I don't know what to do," he said. "They won't let me stay here without money. They've bled me white already. You don't understand these people." "Not half as well as they seem to understand you," I told him. "It is because of the girl, isn't it?" He looked down and didn't answer. "Then," I went on, "why don't you simply take her away?" But he was dismissing the idea even before I'd finished suggesting it. "That's not possible," he said. "It pains her to walk any distance." And then, going on as if this minor quibble had been enough to put an end to the entire argument, he was getting to his feet and saying, "I can see only one way out. You'd better come with me." He said nothing more as he led the way back towards the barn. Over by another of the outbuildings, I saw one of the four sons watching us as we passed. He made no sign towards us, and Antoine didn't even glance his way. Lisa wasn't there when we arrived, nor did Antoine seem to expect her to be. He went over to the easel, and I followed, and then I waited as he hesitated for a moment before drawing away the paint-splashed cloth that had been draped to protect the canvas. It was a painting in full oils. I stood amazed. It was wonderful. It showed that vision of the first moment in which Antoine had seen Lisa under the chestnut tree. It was every detail that I'd seen, but transformed. I now realized that I'd been so preoccupied with my own discomfort that I'd been aware of almost nothing, nothing at all. Lisa stood, hairbrush in hand, dappled in late afternoon sunlight with soft blue shadows behind her. In her plain features was a kind of quiet beauty as she studied her image in the glass. I knew instinctively that it was a sad picture, a celebration of the brevity of all experience and of life itself. And as I looked, I felt something within me die. I thought of my own pretty, nondescript Fontainebleau landscapes and finally knew for sure that my decision had been a right one. My technique was as good as Antoine's, if not slightly better, but technique was only half of the story. To paint, one first had to see, and I didn't until led to it. "You have to take it to Paris for me," he said. "Sell it for whatever you can get." I nodded slowly. There was no question about it now. I would help him however I could. "I'm envious, you know," I said. "Don't be," he said, staring at his own canvas as if it disturbed him somehow. "The things we want most aren't always the things that make us happy." To be going on with, I gave him most of the money that I had with me, including what I had set aside for a night's lodging before returning to the town. I sensed a certain reluctance in Antoine as we climbed a ladder and he showed me the upper loft where I could sleep, but I took it as a natural aversion to charity between friends. I didn't see it that way. If I was going to be a bourgeois, I thought ruefully, I might as well go the whole hog and become a patron of the arts. A blanket in the hay was not my idea of comfort, but it was all that was available. I was warm enough, but the hay stuck at me through the thin wool from every angle, and though my overcoat rolled made a reasonable pillow, I couldn't help wondering what it would look like when I came to shake it out in the morning. No wonder Antoine was looking such a wreck, I thought, after a week of this. I don't know what time it was when I awoke, but it must have been somewhere around 2 or 3 o'clock. I lay uneasy, looking at where the cloudy, moonlit sky showed through the spaces in the walls, and I heard voices from below. They were whispering, but the night was so still that it was impossible not to hear. "I remember leaving you and your friend," Lisa was saying. "I was so tired after sitting for you this morning, but I don't remember where I went." "You went where you always go," I heard Antoine say, "to the big stack of straw behind the house. You made yourself a space and you burrowed down inside." But the next thing that I knew, it was dark and I was standing out under the tree again. I was exhausted and it was as if I'd been running. What had I been doing? "You were sleeping, that's all, like you always do." But Lisa seemed scared, unable to accept so simple an explanation. "But you know this?" she said insistently. "You've seen me?" There was a long silence from Antoine, and then he said, "Yes." I heard her moving slightly, making the hay rustle. She said, "I sometimes feel as if you're the only one who really sees me, as I am, I mean. As if when you close your eyes, I no longer exist, because I didn't, in a way, before you came along." Antoine said, "That's just foolish talk." Her next question was one that I wouldn't have expected. She said, "Who am I, Antoine?" And she sounded lost and miserable, as if the answer would never be known. "Sleep now," he told her. It was a good suggestion, and one that I wished I could follow. But further sleep seemed to elude me, and all that I could do was to squirm miserably in that itchy byre. Antoine's breathing became deep and noisy, which was of no help, and after a while I heard the sound below of somebody rising and making their way towards the door of the barn. Moving as silently as I could, I crawled over to the trap by which I'd entered the loft and peered down. Lisa was at the doorway, framed in moonlight, and she was looking back at Antoine. I could not make out her expression, but her general attitude suggested a regretful leave-taking. Of Antoine himself, I could see little more than the creamy blur of his shirt in the darkness. Then she turned and walked out into the yard. A board creaked as I moved across to the unglazed window from where I'd be able to see down into the yard, but Antoine didn't stir. She was moving quickly now, and a faint shape in a simple dress, and she was heading towards the back of the house, as Antoine had said, and then as I watched, I saw another form rise from the shadows to meet her. This was, I guessed, from his brutish outline, either the farmer or one of his four sons, and he seemed to have been waiting. I saw him raise a rod or a switch of some kind, and to swipe at the air with it as if to speed her in the direction in which she was already going. He followed her through the gap between the buildings and then bent to something that I couldn't see. But then I heard the scrape of a wooden gate across the rutted dirt and the bang of it falling shut. When they were gone from sight, Lisa, being casually driven ahead like some common farm animal, I returned to my blanket. It was obvious that she'd been expected, up and away the moment that Antoine was fully asleep, like a sheep being called to the fold at the end of the day. And having seen the way in which she'd been treated, I could only reflect that perhaps she'd been right, that Antoine's vision of her differed so much from theirs that it was almost as if he'd actually created her beauty out of some more basic stuff to which she could revert only when Antoine's attention moved elsewhere, as in sleep. And sleep, unexpectedly, was what these idle and speculative thoughts led me to. Breakfast was left outside for us in the morning. It was meager, but decent. Antoine carefully packed the picture, wary of the paint that was still soft in patches. He called it La Jeune Fille au Miroir, the Looking Glass Girl. Lisa sat aside and watched us. She'd returned to the barn at some time before I'd woken. I didn't know when. She said little and ate nothing. I now found it difficult to imagine how I could ever have thought her plain. I suppose that, to develop my fanciful thought from the night before, I now saw her as through Antoine's eyes. My own first impression now counted for nothing. It was not that I had simply changed an opinion to acquiesce to the views of another, but more that I'd found the actual fabric of my world transformed by the intensity of his vision. But it was an intensity that was draining him. I could see he looked no better physically now than when he had, when I'd arrived, and seemed perhaps even a little worse. I wondered if a taste of success from the sale of the painting might nourish him. I was on my way before 10, knowing that I had a long walk and a carriage drive ahead of me before I'd even reached the railway. My toughest boots had leaked a little during the river crossing the previous day, but they'd dried out overnight, and Antoine went out to negotiate a ride of some kind so that I wouldn't be restarting the journey with a squelch. I didn't know what was said or what was promised, but after 10 minutes, a dilapidated trap, pulled by an even more dilapidated pony, came rattling into the yard. The morning sun struck a shimmering light from the river as we waved our goodbyes, and my transport jarred its way into the rutted crossing. My driver was one of the four brothers that I'd seen on my first visit to the farm, and I wondered if he might have been the one who had waited in the yard for Lisa in the moonlight. I thought about asking, but he hadn't said one word to me so far, and seemed unlikely to. He sat with his shoulders hunched, and his eyes apparently fixed on the horse's rear end. I was half expecting to be set down on the opposite bank, but it soon became clear that Antoine's bargaining would take me farther as we continued, wheels dripping down the lane. I turned for one last wave to Antoine's solitary figure, and then I faced front with La Jeune Fille au Miroir held protectively by my side. I had a strange feeling of loss, as if I'd left a world that I might never be sure of re-entering. The river was its boundary, the banks its borderland. 10 minutes later, as we came into sight of the main crossroads, my coachman spoke. "We've told your friend," he said, suddenly, without any preamble. "We can't eat his pictures. When his money's gone, so's he." It was a moment before I could be certain that I was the one being addressed. He hadn't lifted his eyes from the mare's backside. But when I was sure, I said, "Would you consider letting Lisa come away with him?" I watched for a reaction, but saw none. He simply said, "Why?" "She doesn't work for you. She isn't one of you. There's no future for her here. Antoine's family is very rich. He could set her up in an apartment of her own and give her an income. She could send you money." It was my boldest stroke, but it was having little effect. He was shaking his head slowly, and this angered me. "I'd rather late to start considering her moral welfare, isn't it?" I demanded, "since you see fit to send her out to sleep in a barn with strangers." "That doesn't matter," he said, reining the nag in so that we came to a halt at the empty crossroads. "She can't leave, that's all." Such were my initial efforts on Antoine's behalf, and I now have to report that I had little more success in my new role as artist's agent. I gave my choice of dealer a lot of thought and settled on one whom I believed would be sympathetic to the picture's fresh and quite modern approach to its subject. He had, I knew, recently made a buying trip to England and returned with several works of Constable that were considered to be almost revolutionary in their treatment of nature. I left the painting in his hands for several days and then called on him to check on progress. He'd found a buyer, but when I heard the sum on offer, my initial excitement died and went cold within me. "So little?" I said. "But well, you might get more if you let it hang in the gallery for a few weeks, but I doubt it," he said. "And I wouldn't want to get a reputation for handling this kind of material." But then he conceded, "I'm not saying it isn't good, but if it's good, it must bring more." "Not so. Good isn't what sells. Fashionable is what sells. We're talking about classical characters in idealized landscapes, nature rearranged in the studio. Now you tell me, how do I sell this little farm girl in a market like that?" It was a good piece of work. I knew it with a greater confidence than I had ever brought to any work of my own. I said, "Are you telling me that this painting is at fault because there's too much of the truth in it?" He shrugged delicately. "If you like, for what it's worth. I think your friend's very brave, but I can't sell his nerve either. I just sell pictures." What could I do? Antoine's tenure at the farm would last only as long as his ability to pay matched the greed of his landlords. The sum I'd been offered wouldn't buy him more than a few days' grace at current rates, but any effort to find a better price for the picture would take time. Even then, there was no guarantees of any greater success. With a sense of defeat, I accepted the offer. There had to come a point, I decided, where Antoine would have to get his obsession into some kind of perspective. He'd found himself in a situation that had made a conceptual breakthrough possible, but now it was time to give some consideration to the strategy of his new career. After all, hadn't he already made his first commercial sale? And if I was beginning to sound like his father in this way of thinking, I didn't dwell on the fact long enough for it to bother me. I went out again on the following Sunday. Antoine was waiting for me on the wrong side of the river. He was sitting on a rock by the crossing, staring into the fast-running current. If I'd been shocked by his appearance before, I was horrified now. He was filthy and wretched, his skin gray with ill health under its ingrained surface of dirt. His hair was like old straw, and his entire body was hunched and bent. I saw what looked like dried wounds on his hands, and when he looked up at my approach, it was with the eyes of the starving. For a moment, I was unable to speak. To see a friend reduced so far, so fast. His bags, easel, and paints were beside him. They lay as if thrown there, the easel broken and the paints scattered and trampled into the riverside mud. "Antoine," I finally managed to say, "what happened here?" "The money was gone, so they threw me out," he said simply. His voice was rough and weak. "I've been here for 2 days. When I tried to go back in, they set the dogs on me." This, I assumed, would explain the wounds on his hands. "That's outrageous," I said. "I'm going to speak to them. Let them set the dogs on me, if they dare." I stormed across the ford, not caring how much noise I made nor how much spray I created. Antoine, after rising unsteadily from his rock, hesitated for a while and then began to follow me at a distance. The yard was in silence, and to me seemed just as grim as it had on that first day. Lisa's mirror no longer hung under the chestnut tree, and from the dark stains on the ground, I'd have guessed that the butchery hooks had been put to recent use. With Antoine still trailing along behind, I took a look in the barn. Some of the hay had been carted out, but there was no sign of anyone around. "We're too late," Antoine said, but I paid him no attention and went out through the back doors of the barn. Out here, at least, I found a sign of life in the form of the remains of a recent fire. It was smoking still, and as I drew closer, I saw that the smoke actually came from a scattering of almost extinct coals in the bottom of a shallow pit. They lay on a bed of deep ash, and there was more ash and hay mingled in with the earth that had been spaded out onto the ground beside the excavation. Even without extending my hand, I could feel the heat. I was not to be stopped. Antoine started to speak again, but I didn't want to listen. I was already on my way towards the stone house with its steeply pitched roof and its inch-thick doors, as stolid and as resistant to inquiry as I knew the people inside it to be. I strode across a kitchen garden where almost nothing grew and hesitated at the side entrance. I could hear noises from inside, the sounds of a number of people together, and so, without knocking, I threw back the unbolted door before me and stepped through. The noise ended as I entered, as sharply as if it had been cut by a blade. I saw a plain, whitewashed room with a broad table down its center, around which at least a dozen people sat. It seemed that the same face toward me in 12 or 13 slightly differing forms, from a child of 3 to a woman so old and pale that she seemed bloodless. One of them, a man of around 30 years, was bibbed like a baby and being fed with a spoon. All of their eyes, save his, were on me. He continued to look eagerly at his plate. I'd interrupted a feast, and a strange feast it was. On the table stood nothing but meat and dishes of liquid fat, and more of this in one spread than such a family might normally expect to see in a year. I saw joints and ribs and bones already picked clean, and at the far end of the table, a plate piled high with roasted offal. This, I didn't doubt, was all the product of the cooking pit that I'd seen behind the barn. The sight and the smell made me queasy at the excess on display. The faces that now studied me were bloated and smeared with grease. Nobody spoke, but in my mind, I heard that voice from days before. "Tell your friend we can't eat his pictures." And then came something that terrified me, as if the hooks that held the backcloth of my world had suddenly slipped in their holes and allowed a corner to fall, revealing the dark machinery that usually stood concealed. It happened as my gaze came to rest on one of the smaller serving dishes, runny with juices and melted fat. The joint that lay on it was charred around the edges, the skin scored and crisp, but for no more than a second, it was recognizable, nails and all, as a human hand. I blinked and stared, and even as I did so, the joint seemed to shimmer and to change, becoming indistinct for a moment before being restored to my sight in a less obvious form. I might have called it an illusion, but I knew that it was not. It was, I am certain, the final demise of Antoine's vision, crushed by the presence of the same poverty and ignorance and need that had given it birth. The retarded 30-year-old began to wail and to drum on the table with his fists, and I took 3 halting steps back and grabbed at the door handle to pull it closed on that terrible scene. Antoine hadn't followed me to the house. He'd stayed back and now waited at some distance. He seemed to be hugging himself, his left arm holding his right as if he was nursing some half-healed bruise. I went across to him and turned him and began to usher him out of the yard, and he complied without protest. On the other side of the river, we gathered up such of his things as were worth taking away. I gave him a few small pieces to carry, but the heaviest baggage I carried myself. It was in this way that we walked down the lane, myself well laden, and Antoine allowing himself to be hastened along. I couldn't take him on to the railway, not in a public compartment in his present state and condition, but there was enough money from the sale of the painting to be able to afford a horse and carriage to take us all of the way back to Paris. We would arrive late and in darkness, but that would be no disadvantage. I spoke on the subject only once as we left Corbeil after a half hour's rest. Antoine was huddled by the window, looking like a bundle of miserable sticks. I said, "When you slept, do you know where she went to?" Antoine slowly turned his head so that his bleak eyes met mine. "I never wondered," he said. And although I knew that he lied, I never asked him again. We conclude with a story from the July 1986 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is Tap Dancing Down the Highways and Byways of Life, etc., by Barry N. Maltzberg. He came out of the hedges with an angrily uncertain expression, a hesitancy in his gestures. The gun, however, looked quite positive as he shoved it in my ribs. "Give me all your money," he said, "right now." "This isn't very nurturing of you, Cecil," I said. "It also isn't legal." "Don't give me nurturing," he said in a tortured whine. "Just give me the money." Carefully, I put my hand in my pocket, fumbled for my wallet. "You'll regret this, Cecil," I said. "I know your parents. They'll be ashamed of you." He reversed the gun and slammed me across the face with the butt. I do not mind saying that it hurt, but I took it with frozen expression, resolved not to show emotion. As he shifted the gun back to firing position, I could feel the blood crawling down a cheekbone. How humiliating, I thought. But of course, humiliation is part of the package here. "Just shut up and hand it over now," he said. The gun shook in his hand. Overhead, a helicopter prowled, rattling the sky. I could smell the gasoline fumes leaching onto the pastoral, deserted suburban streets. This civilization guards at all times against the illusion of beauty. I opened the wallet and stroked the bills, took out the clumped hundreds. "Now," I said, "you should understand remorse." "Fool," he said, snatching the wallet from my hand. "The whole thing." He backed away 2 pieces, clawed through it. $3,000, he said at length. "You're holding out on me. Where's the rest of it?" "I gave you all I had, Cecil." "You're a liar," he said. His face clutched in petulance. It looked as if he were going to cry, a most embarrassing posture for a man of his age and history. "I want it all." He seized me by the throat, squeezed. The impact made me groan, and I could feel a fresh wave of blood cascading. "Give it to me," he said. I struggled in my pocket, removed the 10 hundreds I had folded away separately. "Here," I said, suffocating in his grasp, barely able to articulate, as if it will do you any good. He released me, pushed me away, counted the money frantically. There's still another 100, he said. You're holding out on me. That's all of it, I said. I stood, shaking by the fence, the helicopter clattering overhead, feeling the pain now. You ought to be ashamed of yourself, Cecil. A man of your background, your opportunities. Your parents will be horrified when I tell them. He looked at me with fury and then suddenly centered the gun. I told you to shut up, he said. You mention my name or my parents again and I'll blow you away. It's the truth, Cecil, I said angrily, touched, felt the pain in my injured throat. You're a disgrace to your heritage and everyone should know about it. I'll tell. The bullet caught me squarely in the forehead and I fell. His receding footsteps mingled with the sound overhead. I lay near the tangled bushes for a good 15 or 20 minutes this time. I must have been dead when they finally pulled me up with the ropes, took me inside, returned me to the All-Purpose Institute, and performed the standard procedures. At length, cleaned up and given fresh clothing, the cuts on the face were superficial, but they had to do painstaking work on a bruised larynx. I was hauled in front of them and roundly chastised. I know, I said, hoping to forestall more of it after the initial onslaught. I shouldn't have done it. You're a fool, the examiner said. You were everything wrong, even worse than the first time. Sometimes I have to be given a little more time, I said, rather sullenly, I suppose. I may not be the quickest learner, but once I know, I really know. You mentioned his name. You invoked a personal relationship. You mentioned his parents. You held out on him, not once, but twice. That's really stupid. I get angry, I said. You can't get angry if you want to survive, you fool. How many times must you be told that? I'll be better, I said. The cut still stung. I ran a finger over it lightly. I don't want to go through this much more. Then get it right, the examiner said. We have only so much time for each of you, you understand. All right, I said. I knew that I should be submissive, cooperative, but a tiny core of revulsion still persisted. These are our streets, you know. It was my neighborhood. You cannot get ideological. That is the last thing. All right, I said. I know. I sat there quietly, nodded with agreement to everything that was subsequently said to me, and at length they let me go. It was agreed to run the circumstance immediately. The best lessons are not assimilated to be reenacted in the morning. As soon as he came from the hedges, I knew I was in trouble. His eyes looked desperate, and the gun was shaking in his hand, probably because this was his first robbery. Oh, my God, I said, please don't shoot. I'll give you everything. Give me the money, he said. With the cap pulled over much of his head and with the huge gun, he was a menacing figure. If one could look past the facts that I knew all so well, I allowed the terror to fill me. Here, I said, handing him my wallet. Oh, here it is. Just don't shoot me. He clawed rapidly through the contents. They told me you were carrying 5,000, he said. Where is it? It's all there, I said. Just count it again. The clatter of the helicopter rattled the street. A shadow passed across us. I was careful not to look up, not to acknowledge the observation in any way. He jammed the wallet into his pocket. All right, he said. Turn around and start walking. Don't look back. Can't I just stay here? I said. You'll shoot me in the back. Stop complaining. Just turn around and start walking. Oh, Cecil, I said, these cheap theatrics, these little scenarios of intimidation. He stared at me. Don't use my name, he said. I hate my name. Maybe if you stopped hating yourself, Cecil, you wouldn't do things like this. The gun began to waver in his hand. God damn you, he said. Start walking. Get away. You ought to be ashamed of yourself, I said. What your parents will say when I tell them. I never saw him aim and fire this time, but I do remember the impact of the stones as most heavily I went down. They must have been furious this time. It was hours before I found myself restored, and then they had left tooth bruises I had taken on the knees when I went down so rapidly. The examiner stared at me with loathing. "You'll never learn," he said. "You just never learn." "I'm trying," I said. He got me angry. The business of turning my back to him and walking, it was humiliating. "Don't tell me about humiliation," the examiner yelled. He stood only 5.5 feet, but intimidating on the podium, his mustaches flaring, his face diffused. "You people infuriate me. You don't understand. You'll never learn. But I'm going to make you learn, because that's our responsibility here." "All right," I said. "I'll say nothing. Whatever he says, I'll accept. Whatever he orders, I'll do it." I felt a sudden twist of pain coming from my legs. "I'm sick of being killed and killed, pistol whipped and beaten up, you know." "Not sick enough," the examiner said firmly. "We're running out of chances, you know. One more failure and you're going to fail altogether. We'll have to send you back." "No," I said. "No, I don't want that. Think of what your parents will say." "All right," I said. I meant it. I could feel my own features flushing. "I'll shut up. I won't say anything." "It's in your hands," the examiner said. He was breathing hard, almost as hard as Cecil when he fired the gun. "Ultimately, you have to accept the responsibility. Don't you see that?" Stumbling down the street, I thought I did. I thought that I saw his point. His point was well taken. Urban existence is impossible. One must learn at all costs how to survive. The sound of the observing helicopter tracking me made me ill. The fumes started me gagging. I was sick of it. The examiner was right. There was a time for student folly, but there was also a time to grow up. I had to grow up. He came from the hedges, extending the gun. "Give me all the money," he said. He was nervous and uncertain, but the gun was convincing, enormously convincing. I knew what it could do now. I handed him the wallet, the money protruding from it. He snatched it from me, backed away, clawing through it in both hands. "All right," he said. "It's all there. Now lie down and close your eyes and count to 250. Slow. Don't move." I pointed to the sidewalk. "Right here?" "No, dummy, in the goddamn mud, over there." I looked to the right at the slimy substance, still drenched from the recent rain. "There?" I said. "It's dirty." He waved the gun at me, his control breaking. "Down," he said. "Down, down, down in the mud." The helicopter's sound seemed to overwhelm us as it approached. We were completely in its shadow. Of course, he never acknowledged its presence. He is programmed not to. "Down," he screamed. I looked at the filth, at the gun, towards the invisible, implacable, observing eyes in the copter. "Oh, the hell with it," I said. "Screw you, Cecil," I said. "I won't do it. I won't cooperate." I spat in his face. Even at distance, it landed solidly. He stared at me with fury, wiped at it, then raised the gun. "You fool," I thought to myself. "Your parents will cry at your execution, Cecil," I hurled at him. He fired the gun, flame from the muzzle, etc., quite accustomed to the consequences by this time. I died quite neatly. I wondered if they'd even bother to revive me this time. It seemed unlikely. I was hardly worth it to them. I'd never be able to live in their cities. I just couldn't be a victim. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader of Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.